All right, listen, I'd like to pick up tonight where we had left off in the book of Nehemiah. We left off in chapter 4. And if you haven't been here, I mean, I don't really have time to go recap that much. But one thing I just want to emphasize is that Nehemiah is leading this effort to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. And we've got to look at the spiritual context of this wall. Because like I think I was sharing the other night, if we go back to what Paul says in 1 Corinthians in chapter 5, he says in verse 9, he says, I wrote in my letter not to associate with immoral people. I did not at all mean that with the immoral people of this world or with the covetous and the swindlers or with the idolaters, for then you would have to go out of the world. But actually I wrote to you not to associate with any so-called brother if he should be an immoral person or covetous or idolater or reviler or drunkard or swindler, not even to eat with such a one. For what have I to do with judging outsiders? Do you not judge those who are within the church? She says, but those who are outside God judges. Remove the wicked man from among yourselves. And I just read that to kind of recap the fact that, okay, the wall of Jerusalem that Nehemiah is rebuilding, it's very, very significant in its symbolism. And the symbolism points to the very fact that as a church, as God's people, we really do need to insulate ourselves. We need to be separated from the world. We need this wall of separation. Now, I know in Peter, he talks about how we are all living stones being built up into the temple of God. Well, the temple of God isn't actually the wall that we're reading about here, because the temple was separate from the wall. And, you know, I don't want to torture it to try to make that application, but I do think that there is some parallels there. And at the same token, you know, if you look at the wall and understand what the wall represents, in a sense, the wall represents God's truth. It represents God's laws. It represents God's statutes, His ordinances, His ways. This is what this wall represents. And if we look at the wall today, spiritually speaking, now in our own country, we can see that this wall is completely torn down. It's completely demolished. I mean, God's rules, His ordinances, His commandments, His statutes, everything that is set forth in the Scripture as far as God's truth and God's word and God's will and God's ways is concerned, it's been completely undermined, all right, by God's enemies and completely destroyed. And so when Nehemiah is leading a contingency of people to rebuild this wall, it has a tremendous spiritual significance for us today, because as Christians today, we really do need to make a concerted effort to rebuild this wall in regards to God's truth. And when we make that attempt to rebuild the wall and put God's truth back where it belongs, well, we are going to be attacked. We are going to be vilified. We are going to be mocked. We are going to be ridiculed. Why? Because we are told in Ephesians chapter 6 that we don't wrestle against flesh and blood, but we wrestle against these spiritual forces of wickedness in heavenly places. We wrestle against these demonic spiritual hordes that are hell-bent on destroying mankind and blaspheming God and destroying His church and doing everything they can to mock God and bring down His laws. That's what we're dealing with here. All right. So when we're reading what's taking place here in the book of Nehemiah as far as the rebuilding of the wall, don't think for one minute that this is just a lot of useless information that happened thousands of years ago and has no relevance for us today, because God put it in His word for our instruction. I mean, that's what we are told in the New Testament. I mean, that all Scripture is given to us for our edification, for our reproof, for our instruction, for our example. We are told that in 1 Timothy 3 or 2 Timothy 3. So when we get into this chapter 4 now, I think we get an idea of what Nehemiah has to contend with as far as his enemies are concerned. Beginning with that verse 1 in chapter 4, it says, Now it came about that when Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, he became furious and very angry and mocked the Jews. And he spoke in the presence of his brothers and the wealthy men of Samaria and said, What are these feeble Jews doing? Are they going to restore it for themselves? Can they offer sacrifices? Can they finish in a day? Can they revive the stones from a dusty rubble, even the burned ones? Now, Tobiah and the Ammonite was near him, and he said, Even what they are building, if a fox should jump on it, he would break their stone wall down. And then Nehemiah says in verse 4, Hear, O our God, how we are despised. Return the reproach on their own heads and give them up for plunder in the land of captivity. Do not forgive their iniquity and let not their sin be blotted out before thee. For they have demoralized the builders. So we built the wall, and the whole wall was joined together to half its height, for the people had a mind to work. Now here's the situation. Here is the way the devil works. You can see it. It's almost predictable. If you've been a Christian for a long enough time and you've been in the spiritual battle, you can almost see it. how the devil will attack you from one front, and if he can't get to you on that front, he'll attack you from a different front, and a different front, and a different front. You know, there's an old saying that says something to the effect that different level, different devil. I mean, in our spiritual walk, the more levels that we climb up in our spiritual walk, the more different devils we're going to have to deal with. Well, this first attack comes from, you know, the surrounding enemies of the Jews. They are the enemies of God's people. This Tobiah and the Ammonite and the Arab and these other people, they're trying to discourage people from building this wall. The first thing they do is they ridicule and they insult and they mock. And look at today. I'll give you an example. Look at the National Endowments for the Arts, okay? Here's a situation where, remember when they had, this crucifix they put in a jar of urine, and they called it Piss Christ, and they put it in a museum, and this is supposed to be art? Or remember the situation where they had Jesus Christ portrayed at the Last Supper as a woman with bared breasts? Now stop for a minute. You know, the world, these are the Tobiases of the world, okay? These are the Ammonites, in a sense that these are the enemies of God's people that are doing this, all right? And what they are really doing is they're mocking our faith. They're insulting our faith. They're insulting our God. Because here's a situation where you've got all of these so-called intellectuals, these cultural elite, these people who are in charge of this museum, and all their followers and all their backers, they're saying, hey, this is a freedom of choice. This is a freedom of expression. This is our constitutional right, that these people have a right to express themselves any way that they want. But I'll just throw this out. I think anybody with an IQ of 2 knows this in their heart of hearts. What if they took a figure of Martin Luther King and they submerged it in a jar of urine and they called it Piss Martin, all right? Or what if they took a figure or a picture of Muhammad the Prophet and did the same thing to it? Or what if they took a Jewish figure, let's say Moses, and they did that to insult the Jews? I mean, you tell me, what would be the outcry? What would be the end result? There's not one of these stinking no-good-for-nothing artists, so-called artists, that are really nothing more than anti-artists, all right? They're not one of them. Not one of them would dare do such a thing. Because they know, that these people are not going to put up with that. You see, they know, hey, it's open season on Christians. You can bash Christians, you can bash Christ, you can bash God all you want, and you can get away with it. It's hilarious what you can get away with. I mean, you can bash them on TV. These stand-up comics do it all the time. Hollywood does it. The cinema does it. Television does it. The media does it. Our academia does it, especially in our colleges and universities. Hey, man, it's open season on Christians, right? But try doing that to Martin Luther King. Try doing that to Muhammad. Try doing that to any of these other people. You see what happens? You see what I'm saying? What I'm reading here is the first attack is insult, okay? Mock, ridicule. That's what they're doing. That's what they do to Christians today. They try to discourage Christians by their insulting. Here's another example of how they will attack us. When a Christian stands up and says, you know what? Evolution is nothing but a lie. And you say that, and how are they going to attack you? They're going to attack you saying, well, you are just ignorant. You are stupid. You are superstitious. They will attack you on quote-unquote intellectual grounds. These so-called intellectuals, and all they are is a bunch of pompous, good-for-nothings who will look at you and say, science proves evolution. And anybody who knows what's going on knows that evolution has not been proven one bit. They've dug from here to China to find some kind of missing link, and they can't find it. But you stand up and you confront these people. How do they attack you? They attack you by their ridicule. They say that you're ignorant, you're superstitious, you're stupid. Science has all the answers. See what I'm saying? It's always the same attack. But the people who are trying to build up this wall of truth, they're going to be attacked in that way. And that's what happens here. These people, they attack God's people by trying to discourage them that way. But look what it says here in that verse 6. So we built the wall, and the whole wall was joined together to its half its height, for the people had a mind to work. So this is what I think is going to guarantee a success with the grace of God in this work, is if we have a mind to work, God's people. If all God's people had a mind to work, I think we could turn things around. But here's the problem. I do not feel like there's that many people in the church today who have a mind to work in terms of building up this wall of God's truth, of His commandments, of His ordinances, of His statutes, this type of thing. They don't have a mind to work. I mean, I'm not trying to be anybody's judge and insult anybody. I'm just simply saying that if everybody who claimed to be a Christian today had a mind to work, we could turn things around. But the problem is, what's happening is that God's enemies are making enormous inroads into the church and destroying this wall because there's way too many people within the church who are apathetic, indifferent, and lukewarm and don't care. All right? Look what happened down here in New Orleans and with this Hurricane Katrina. I mean, literally, you know, the spiritual-minded person can see that that was just God's backhand. He just slapped that upside the head. You know, destroyed an entire city, probably three cities, all right, with very minimal loss of life, and yet at the same time, it's utterly destroyed as far as all of his wealth is concerned. You see what I'm saying? This is a judgment from God. But how many people are looking around saying, well, yeah, are recognizing that? Because look what's happened here in California. Right in the midst of this judgment, we have these legislatures in California who have passed a bill that says, okay, you know, we are now going to permit same-sex marriage. Well, thank God our governor vetoed it. He said, listen, the people have shot this down, you know, so I'm not going to go against the people. But the fact remains, you know, these legislators have passed this law right in the midst of this judgment. See what I'm saying? This is what we're dealing with today, all right? And if people had a mind to work, we could turn things around. But people don't have a mind to work. As a matter of fact, there's so many people in the church today who compromise with evil to the point where it's just making these inroads. You see, that verse 7 says, now it came about when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, and the Ammonites, and the Ashdodites, or in other words, the Philistines, heard that the repair of the wall of Jerusalem went on and that its breaches began to be closed, they were very angry. Okay, you know, these are God's enemies. Okay, look at it. Imagine to yourself that if the Christians began to make inroads in this country in terms of turning around Roe versus Wade, I mean, turning around our abortion laws, turning around our pornography laws, or turning around, you know, all this BS as far as evolution being taught to our schools and all these other things that are going on. If we were to make an effort to start, and they could see things being turned around, I could guarantee you, the ACLU, you know, basically the entire Democratic Party and a lot of the Republican Party and a number of other people would be so hostile. They'd be just like what it's saying here, you know, and they would, then when the breaches began to be closed, they were very angry. And all of them conspired together to come and fight against Jerusalem and to cause a disturbance in it. Now, okay, their first line of attack didn't work. Their first line of attack was what? It was ridicule. It was mocking. It was insulting. And they tried to discourage the workers, but the workers started to anything is around. Now they plan to attack them physically. All right. So it says, but we prayed to our God, and because of them, we set up guards against them day and night. Thus in Judah, it was said, the strength of the burden bearer is failing, yet there is much rubbish, and we ourselves are unable to rebuild the wall. Now, here's a situation that's okay. Now they're being threatened. Their very lives are being threatened. All right. And this is what happens with God's people. I mean, if their lives aren't being threatened, certainly you can see it in other parts of the world. You can see it with these radical Muslims who, you know, think nothing of blowing themselves up as long as they can kill, you know, innocent Jews or Christians or, you know, Westerners or whoever. This is what we have to contend with. And in the midst of this, when the job is almost halfway through, what does it say here? It says in that verse 10, it says, thus in Judah it was said, the strength of the burden bearers is failing, yet there is much rubbish, and we ourselves are unable to rebuild the wall. This is, I think, what happens sometimes when we start working for God. When we start out working for God, all right, I think a lot of times there might be a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of zeal, a lot of high hopes, all right? But when the project gets only about halfway done, I think a lot of times there can set in some disillusionment, some discouragement, some frustration, because you recognize you've invested so much time, money, energy, and effort into a project, and you still have a long way to go. And that can be a dangerous time, I believe. Rachel, you were talking about this idea of maybe converting as many people as possible in Del Oro. That is a really commendable, and I really, you know, support you guys 100%. But I would say this, don't get discouraged, because there'll come a time when you'll feel like, hey man, we're getting nowhere, and it doesn't look like we're going to reach our goal, and you'll get very discouraged. Well, that's the time to kind of suck it up and to keep going. As they said in verse 11, it says, and our enemies said, they will not know or see until we come upon them and kill them and put a stop to the work. And it came about that when the Jews who lived near them came and told us 10 times, quote, they will come up against us from every place where you may turn. In other words, what it's saying here is, I believe that, they had a bunch of Jews who lived in the outlying areas or outlying cities from the city of Jerusalem itself, but they would go home at night and then they'd come back in the day to help build the wall. Well, when they were going home at night, they were being harassed by these by their enemies, and they were saying, we're going to attack you. So, the people that come in, from these other cities, they tell me, Nehemiah, they told him 10 different times that these people are intent on, attacking us physically. And then verse 13, it says, then I stationed men in the lowest parts of the space behind the wall, the exposed places, and I stationed the people and families with their swords and spears and bows. And when I saw their fear, I rose and spoke to the nobles of the officials and the rest of the people. And I said, do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers and your sons and your daughters and your wives and your houses. Now, here's the thing. Nehemiah could see that, well, now the people are becoming pretty concerned, and they're becoming afraid, and they're having second thoughts about, the work that they started. But here, to me, is a real, I think, dynamic leader. When he's able to say to these people, hey, remember the Lord. That's what he says in that verse 14. Remember the Lord. It's kind of like a battle cry, remember the Alamo, or remember like even World War I, the Lusitania, or remember Pearl Harbor, or whatever. It gives people a rallying point to just say, hey man, there's something greater at stake here than what just meets the eye. And so what he does is I think he really encourages these people, because if it wasn't for Nehemiah, I really believe this work would have fell by the wayside. I really do. Just like when they started building the temple the first time around under Zerubbabel, the people got really discouraged because they were attacked in that situation. And they end up just, everybody went home. They gave up. They figured, well, it's not time yet. And then God started sending judgment against them because, they completely neglected his house. And so, it took them like 22 years to finally finish the temple. But it took two prophets, Zechariah and Haggai, to motivate these people to get back to work. Well, Nehemiah won't let these people stop. He's saying, we've got to keep going, got to keep going. And to me, I have a great deal of respect for this guy, because first of all, he's a layman. He's not a Levite, he's not a priest, but he really inspired people to work for God. And I think that's what we need in this country. I don't think there's enough ordained pastors, ministers, and priests who are out there. Well, I know there are some good ones, but I also know there's a lot of ones that aren't so good. And I think that there's lay people that need to pick up the slack and fill in the breaches or fill in the gaps, and pick up the standard and keep going. And that's certainly what Nehemiah did. In verse 15 it says, and it happened that when our enemies heard that it was known to us and that God had frustrated their plan, then all of us returned to the wall, each one to his work. And it came about from that day on that half of my servants carried on the work, while half of them held spears and shields and bows and the breastplates, and the captains were behind the whole house of Judah. Now, here's the thing that I think is very practical about the way Nehemiah approaches this, is that he figures, okay, these people are threatening to attack us, so we really have to pray as if everything depends upon God and work as if everything depends upon ourselves. Because what does he do? He gets half of the people working now and half of the people guarding, armed to the teeth in case they are attacked. And don't forget, I think there's a spiritual parallel you can draw from Ephesians 6, where it says, put on the full armor of God. It says the helmet of salvation, the breastplate of righteousness, and gird your loins with truth, and the sword of the Spirit, and the shield of faith, and the shod your feet with the preparation of the gospel of peace. In other words, we are in a spiritual warfare, so I think you can make that application. In verse 17 it says, and those who were rebuilding the wall and those who carried burdens took their load with one hand, doing the work, and the other holding a weapon. And as the builders each wore his sword girded at his side as he built, while the trumpeter stood near me. And I said to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people, the work is great and extensive, and we are separated on the wall far from one another. At whatever place you hear the sound of the trumpet, rally to us here. Our God will fight for us. So we carried on the work with half of them holding spears from dawn until the stars appeared. And at that time I also said to the people, let each man with his servant spend the night within Jerusalem so that they may guard for us by night and a laborer by day. So neither I, my brothers, my servants, nor my men, or the guards who followed me, none of us removed our clothes. Each of us took his weapon even to the water. So here's a situation I think, you know, draw spiritual applications as well, because he's saying here that the work is extensive, and he's got people working all over on this wall, and he figures, okay, if one part of the wall is attacked, he has a trumpeter with him, and he's going to blow the trumpet, and then everybody's to drop what they're doing and rush to that place where they're being attacked. All right? And I look at it this way. If everybody who claimed to be a Christian in America would do that, wherever we are being attacked, in mass, would counterattack. And what I mean by that is when, let's just say, all the garbage that comes through on TV, all right? Let's just say every show that blasphemes God or that mocks his laws, all right? If every professing Christian were to just say, oh, you know what? We're going to change the channel here, all right? We're going to watch something different. And then they write or they email or whatever to these networks to say, you know what? I'm not watching this garbage, all right? I've turned the channel. And if that's all that's on TV, I'm going to turn my TV off. And if everybody did that, I guarantee you, by tomorrow, these guys would be running scared, and they'd change their program. So this is what I'm driving at here, all right? If we who profess to believe in God would really push back, instead of always being pushed around, we could see this country turned around overnight. But it's not going to happen, because there's what's happening around us is that there's way too many people who are apathetic, lukewarm, indifferent, who are sitting in the pews, or who will give God head acknowledgement. And so there's only, in essence, just a minority of people who are really the ones who are trying to build up this wall. But it's almost an impossible task, given everything that's mounted against us, because there's just not enough people. And the people that are, how many of them really have a mind to work? Or they can become discouraged.
And you know what, John, I think part of it is, I mean, and sometimes we don't realize what a power we are together in the Lord. And even if we didn't do anything but pray, because a lot of times you do feel... you know, like it's government. What can you do?
Yeah,
you
help
know?
Us. Yeah,
and we get discouraged. And I think that's kind of what it's saying too. We can buoy each other up, because we're always going to come against the devil anytime you try to do something good. And you know, the very least we can do is pray. And we don't even think to do that sometimes. I mean, I'm putting my name at the top of the list. Sometimes you just get discouraged, and you don't realize, you know, that God said that greater is he that is in you.
Right.
And together, I mean, that's a pretty powerful...
Right. But that's what it's going to take. It's going to take a coordinated effort. It's going to take the church working, you know, together. That's what Nehemiah has all these people doing, man. He has got them working together, defending themselves together, defending each other's back together. He's made every contingency that, hey, man, if we're going to be attacked here, we're going to blow the trumpet and everybody's going to counterattack. This is a spiritual warfare that we're in. Mm-hmm. Now, unfortunately, I really feel like we have lost the culture of war. Now, call me a pessimist, call me Mr. Puddleglum, call me anything you want, but hey, I'm just a realist. I'm looking at what is happening around us, and I do not see this changing. What God did down there in New Orleans, you know, by rights, this whole country should be on their face and asking God's forgiveness and recognizing that this is a judgment from God. Mm-hmm. But it's not going to happen. Everybody feels like, look at the blame game that's going on because of what happened down there. I mean, everybody's being blamed, from the president down to the dog catcher. You know, everybody's shifting the blame and so on and so forth. But nobody's really taking a look at the situation from a spiritual perspective and saying, hey, man, It says in Chronicles that if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, I will heal their land. That's the only way we're going to be healed. But instead, we feel like, well, what we got to do is we got to rebuild. We got to throw more money about it, at it. We got to do this, that, and the other thing. But nobody, I've yet to hear anybody stand up and say, you know what? We need to repent. That's our only hope. We need to turn to God in repentance. You know. Anyway, anybody want to add or should that to chapter 4 before we go into chapter 5? Because we get into this chapter 5, it's now another means of attack. But this time, the attack comes from within. And I think the attack that comes from within is sometimes a lot more difficult to deal with than the attacks that happen from without. Look at that, beginning with that verse 1. It says, now there was a great outcry of the people and their wives against their Jewish brothers, for their were those who said, we, our sons and our daughters, are many. Therefore, let us get grain that we may eat and live. And there were others who said, we are mortgaging our fields and our vineyards and our houses that we might get grain because of the famine. And also there were those who said, we have borrowed money for the king's tax on our field and our vineyards. And now our flesh is like the flesh of our brothers, and our children are like their children. Yet behold, we are forcing our sons and our daughters to be slaves, and some of our daughters are forced into bondage already, and we are helpless because our fields and our vineyards belong to others. Then I was very angry when I had heard their outcry and these words, and I consulted within myself and contended with the nobles and the rulers and said to them, you are exacting usury each from his brother. Therefore I held a great assembly against them, and I said to them, we, according to our ability, have redeemed our Jewish brothers who were sold to the nations. Now, should you even sell your brothers that they may be sold to us? Then they were silent and could not find a word to say. And again, I said, the thing which you are doing is not good. Should you not walk in the fear of our God because of the reproach of the nations, our enemies? And likewise, I, my brothers and my servants are lending them money and grain. Please let us leave off this usury. Please give back to them this very day their fields and their vineyards and their olive groves and their houses and their hundredth part of the money and of the grain and the new wine and the oil that you are exacting from them. And then they said, we will give it back and will require nothing of them. We will do exactly as you say. So I called the priests and took an oath from them that they would do according to this promise. So I also shook out the front of my garment and said, thus may God shake out every man from his house and from his possessions who does not fulfill this promise. Even thus may he be shaken out and emptied. And all the assembly said amen, and they praised the Lord. And then the people did according to this promise. Now, the reason I read this far is because this, you can see the whole theme unfold here in these first 13 verses of what's happening now. And what's taking place here is that now they've got internal strife. They're not only dealing from an enemy without, but now they've got this internal strife within. And you can see this within the church and the situation, right? So this is even harder to contend with. And what was basically happening here is that if you go back to the book of Leviticus and you go back to the book of Numbers, God specifically, not Numbers, Deuteronomy, Leviticus, God specifically told his people, listen, if you find your Jewish brother, if he finds himself that's hard-pressed financially, he says, you're not to charge him interest on whatever money you loan him. And as a matter of fact, he even went as far as to say that he expects his people to basically help them out in their time of need. All right? Well, these people just took advantage of the situation. And they just took advantage and exploited these people when they were find themselves in financial straits. And what they did is they had these people, you know, sell their sons and their daughters, or maybe even themselves or their property, to these other rich people. And so the rich Jewish brethren were getting richer and richer, and these people were getting poorer and poorer. And here they are trying to work on this wall, and they don't even have any money to feed themselves or their families now. And when Nehemiah finds out about this, I mean, he just really is livid. He's so angry. He's so ticked off. He gathers together these nobles, and he says, hey, man, what are you doing here? He's saying, basically, he's telling them flat out, you're disobeying God. First of all, we were all sold into slavery in Babylon, and as when we were exiled, and now we come back and we're free, and you're enslaving your brothers all over again. And he's basically just chewing them out. And then they're coming under conviction. But he doesn't, and they say, okay, Nehemiah basically says, you need to give this property back, you need to give this money back, you need to cut these people free. And they're saying, okay, well, we'll do that. But then, you know, he doesn't take them at their word. He calls in the priest and say, has them swear an oath. And he takes his garment, I guess his apron, and he shakes it out and says, hey, man, may God do this to any of you and dispossess you of your land and your possessions and everything you have if you go back on this promise. So, he really kind of put a curse on them, all right, to do the right thing. All right. So, I mean, you look at this situation, and what do you see as far as the spiritual application? You go back to the book of Hebrews, and what does it say? It says, see to it that no root of bitterness spring up among you, lest thereby many be defiled. Let me repeat that, because I think half of you are sleeping. It says, see to it that no root of bitterness spring up among you brothers, lest thereby many become defiled. And so what you see here is that's what was happening. A root of bitterness took place because these people were disobeying God and taking advantage and exploiting their Jewish brethren. And then they put them in a situation where they didn't have the wherewithal to feed their families. And here they are trying to do the God's work. All right. So Nehemiah takes them aside. He lambastes them. And then he gets the priest to have them swear that they will do the right thing. You know, because he knows what human nature is like, all right? He's not just going to take them at their word. He's just going to, you know, basically pronounce a curse upon them if they don't come through with it. Because, I don't know, people are just fickle. I mean, it used to be before my day, but anyway, I heard from my father-in-law and other people that there was a time when a man's word was his bond. All he had to do was say, hey, man, I'll pay you on a certain day. I will do a certain thing. And, you know, you could depend upon him. Nowadays, man, it doesn't matter if you get a notary, get an attorney, get a whole army of attorneys, get you know, all kinds of contracts written up. You know, sometimes it's not even worth the ink that's on the paper. You know, it's so worthless because people are so deceptive. They're so dishonest. I mean, you know, you really have to work at being honest. I'm not kidding you. You really, you have to be a man of your word. Now, I'm not going to say this to boast in any way, but I just tell you, I was tempted the other day to be dishonest monetarily because, I sold my wife's car and, we want to buy another car. And the guy who bought the car said, well, would you mind, giving me a bill of sale that says you sold it for less so I won't have to pay as much taxes, you know, when I go to the DMV? And I had to just flat out tell him, I said, you know what? I said, I'm a Christian and you know, it would be a violation of my conscience to do that because it's basically lying. I says, hey, I really can't stand a DMV myself. And I feel tempted to just say, hey, man, yeah, just tell her you paid $500, $50 for the car as far as I'm concerned. Because as far as I'm concerned, I'm sick and tired of the DMV. I'm sick and tired of the government just taking every, you know, nickel they can get their hands on. I mean, if you stop and look at it, basically 50% of our income goes to taxes. Mm-hmm. I mean, with, property tax and sales tax and excise tax and federal tax. And there's tax on tax. And then there's fees and assessments and fines. And, it goes on and on. And what? Over 50% of our income is going to the government. So sure, inside I just want to say, yeah, sock it to them. I just tell them you paid $5 for the car. I'll sign it. But I couldn't do that. I couldn't do that because I figured, hey, man, that's not honest. And I had to tell the guy, I said, I bought a car for my son and I bought a car for my daughter. And, the temptation was there to say that I paid less for the car than I did. But I went out and I told them exactly what I paid for the car, even though it was costing me more money. To who? The government of all people. Which I could have really justified, rationalized, excused, and said, well, they got enough of my money. But the thing is, God looks for truth in inward parts. You know what I'm saying? He wants us to be honest through and through. And so, I couldn't justify that, even though I really felt tempted to. All right. So I just kind of throw that out there because I'm just simply saying, people have to be men and women of the word. They have to be honest. I am so fed up with the dishonesty in this country. I'm just fed up with it. I've been the victim of people who have been dishonest left and right. I mean, I'm not kidding you. I have been rear-ended a number of times. And one time, I had Rachel in the car. She's a little kid. The guy rear-ended me, busted out the taillight, and put a dent in the bumper. And I just said, oh, look, you know, we're okay, and I'll take care of that. Don't worry about it. And I went on my way, you know, and I fixed it myself. But here was a situation where I could say, oh, my neck, oh, my back, and oh, I'm going to get a lawyer, I'm going to sue. And people, you know, are just suing each other left and right, and so much of it is fraud. It's fraud. It's just flat-out fraud. I had a good buddy of mine when I was younger. He took a key. He wanted a new paint job in his car, so he took a key and just scraped it all the way down the side of his car and all the way back on the other side, and then he took it to the insurance company and said, look, somebody did it in my car. I need a new paint job. And while we were at it, I want the color changed. You know? So, I mean, you know, I'm talking about fraud and dishonesty. But, you see, there's so many people that can justify this, right? They can rationalize this. They can say, hey, man, you know, the insurance will cover this. But guess who's paying the insurance, fool? It's us, right? You look at the human heart. Nehemiah knew the human heart. He knew, hey, man, I'm not going to trust these guys. I'm going to bring him in here and have him swear an oath to God in front of the priest, and I'm going to basically pronounce a curse on them if they don't do the right thing. And what do you know? They did the right thing. Anyway, you know, I was going to go through chapter 6, but we're just going to have to conclude this chapter 5 tonight because kind of got off on a tangent. Sorry. He says in that verse 14, he says, moreover, from the day that I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah, and from the 20th year to the 32nd year of King Artaxerxes, for 12 years, neither I nor my kinsmen have eaten the governor's food allowance. But the former governors who were before me laid burdens on the people and took from them bread and wine and besides 40 shekels of silver, even their servants domineered the people. But I did not do so because of the fear of God. I also applied myself to the work on the wall, and we did not buy any land, and all my servants were gathered there for the work. Moreover, there were at my table 150 Jews and officials, besides those who came to us from the nations that were around us. Now that which was prepared for each day was one ox and 6 choice sheep. Also birds were prepared for me, and once in 10 days, all sorts of wine were furnished in abundance. Yet for all this, I did not demand the governor's food allowance because the servitude was heavy on the people. Remember me, O my God, for good, according to all that I have done for this people. Now, you know, here's a situation. You really see the heart of Nehemiah, and it has sterling character. First of all, he's been appointed governor, and according to this, he's going to be governor for 12 years because he wrote this after everything had taken place. But he's appointed governor, and he says that the governors before him exacted a tax from the people, a governor's allowance, which would, you know, feed his household and take care of all of his wants and needs or whatever. And some of these governors, we know one of them was Zerubbabel, another one was Ezra, and I believe that the other governor, if I'm not mistaken, was Sanballat. That's one of the reasons why he is so adamantly against this building of this wall, because he's losing his power. You know, he's going to lose his influence and his prestige. He's a typical politician. I mean, these people want to be reelected at any cost, at any price. They'll sell their own soul as long as they can keep their lousy power. Well, you know, that's the way this Sanballat was, and yet you see a totally different spirit in Nehemiah. What does he do? He doesn't take one dime from the people. Apparently, he was pretty independently wealthy, and I get the impression, I could be wrong, but remember, he was the king's cupbearer. Well, I believe he had like an ongoing stipend or a paycheck somehow along the way. He was being paid while he was on leave. So, in other words, all this money was coming out of his own pocket. And what was he doing? He was not only not taking money that he was allotted or allowed, all right, but he was providing for his own needs and providing for people, you know, other people's needs at the same time. Remember what Paul said in the New Testament? He talked about the fact that he says he's an apostle. And as an apostle, he has a right to expect people to pay him for his services as an apostle, because that's what Peter did and that's what the other apostles did. You know, the other pillars of the church, when they would preach the gospel, they would be paid to do so. In other words, they would earn their living in preaching the gospel. But Paul said, hey, he didn't want to take one dime for preaching the gospel, even though he was totally, you know, it was totally legitimate for him to do so. Instead, He preached the gospel through the day and part of the night, and he worked the rest of the time making tents or doing other kind of manual labor in order to support himself so he could preach the gospel to other people without charge. You really see the heart of Christ in Paul. You really see it in the heart of Nehemiah when it comes down to being a servant of all. Isn't that what Jesus said? The greatest among you must become the servant of all. Remember the apostles, they were always trying, doing the jockeying back and forth, wondering who was going to be the greatest in the kingdom. And Jesus had to rebuke them and tell them over and over and over again that, look, you want to be the greatest in the kingdom, what you need to do is become everybody's servant. You know, that just goes so against the grain of our way of doing things, right? The greatest among you become the servant of all. And that's what Nehemiah is. He becomes other people's servant. And as a matter of fact, he rolled up his sleeves and he worked on this wall along with everybody else. See what I'm saying? Remember when Jesus, the night before he died, he took a towel, girded himself with a towel, and took a pail of water, went around and washed his disciples' feet. And he said, you know what? He says, you call me Lord and Master, and you're absolutely right. He says, but I've given you an example here that you know, I'm the Lord, I'm the Master, but I have washed your feet. In other words, that I have become your servant. And that's what I want you to do. Become the servant of everyone else. And you see this in Nehemiah. You see, you know, he's a man that he fears God. Even though he feels like, yeah, I could be entitled to all these things, he didn't take it out of fear of God because he knew the people were really struggling. Now, if the people were affluent and they could afford it, hey, he probably wouldn't have had any problem with taking it. But the people were struggling, so he didn't put that burden on them on top of everything else. You see the type of man that he was? And he says, just basically in closing, he says in that verse 19, he says, remember me, O my God, for good, according to all that I have done for this people. You know, if you go back to the book of Hebrews, you know, it says that, I believe in chapter 6, it says that God is not unjust so as to forget the love that you have shown towards his name in ministering and continuing to minister unto the saints. To me, that's pretty encouraging to know that if you just keep serving God's people for his name's sake, you know, it's not going to lose its reward. It's not that we serve God for rewards. We serve God because of what? Because that's what we're made to do. We're made to know, love, serve God with a whole heart, mind, soul, and strength. All right? We don't do it for rewards. Don't do it for a pat on the back. Don't do it for recognition. But you do it out of love for Christ. But it says God is not unjust so as to forget the love that you have shown towards his name in ministering and continuing to minister unto the saints. And when you read this, this is what I think of when I read what Nehemiah says in verse 19. He says, remember me, O my God, for good, according to all that I have done for this people. And just put it in perspective, all right? Let me read that one more time. And just try to apply it to your life and try to apply it to your death. Try to apply it to the end of your life. He says, remember me, O my God, for good, according to all that I have done to this people. You know, God's not going to forget, all right? But think to yourself for a minute. If you spent your life serving Christ with all your heart, all right, what do you think your feeling is going to be if you're laying on your deathbed and you know that your time is up? I don't think, at least I try to put myself in that position. You know, I know for sure I'm not going to say, oh man, I wasted my life, you know, serving Christ all these years. What a bummer. You know, I could have really had a great time. You think I'm going to say that? Through all the struggles of trying to serve him through all these years, if I remain true to this calling and then I see that death is imminent, that's going to be a tremendous comfort to me. I'm not going to say, Lord, I don't deserve anything, and I'm not asking you to deserve anything, but in your graciousness, just try not to remember what a crud I've been, and just in your graciousness, just remember what I've tried to do for your name's sake. You know, that kind of thing. That could be a real comfort in your dying or on your deathbed, you know, rather than having spent your life like Hugh Hefner, and then what's he going to say on his deathbed? You know, people like that who just live their life in the here and now, you know, and to gratify, you know, their every whim rather and don't give God a second thought. Well, they're going to have to account to God for that. Anybody have anyone to add or share what we read tonight?